We'll continue with our reading from Hiroshima Diary. Dr. Katsubi and his staff had an impossible task. There was scarcely a patient who was not in need of urgent surgical care. The doctors and nurses were all busy helping him, even the clerical staff and janitors, and those among the patients who could so much as get about were organized and instructed to help. What progress was made, it was hard to see. How Dr. Katsubi did what he did was a miracle. The corridors were cleared enough to be passable, but in a little while, they were as crowded as before. One difficulty was the influx of people looking for friends and relatives. Parents, half crazy with grief, searched for their children. Husbands looked for their wives, and children for their parents. One poor woman, insane with anxiety, walked aimlessly here and there through the hospital, calling her child's name. It was dreadfully upsetting to patients, but no one had the heart to stop her. Another woman stood at the entrance, shouting mournfully for someone she thought was inside. She too upset us. Not a few came in from the country to look for friends or relatives. They would wander among the patients and peer rudely into every face until finally their behavior became so intolerable that we had to refuse them entrance to the hospital. A new noise reached us from outside. On inquiry, I was told that Dr. Koyama had procured a company of soldiers to clean out the fire-damaged communications bureau so that it could be put in use again as an annex to the hospital. The pharmacy came to life. Our meager supply of drugs was sorted and prepared for use under the watchful supervision of Dr. Hinoi and Mr. Mizoguchi. A little order was appearing. Something positive was being done. Perhaps in time we could get control of the situation. Mr. Serra, the business manager, reported. He told me that 16 patients had died during the night and that he shrouded their bodies in white blankets and deposited them at the side entrance to the hospital. Can we spare those blankets at a time like this? I thought to myself. I was reluctant to object openly to what Mr. Serra had done, because his action had been prompted by his sense of propriety and respect for the dead. When I discovered, however, that the army detail dispatched to remove the dead had thrown the bodies, blankets and all, onto the platform of a truck without any ceremony whatsoever, I seized on this indignity to suggest that our blankets be saved. The living needed the blankets more than the dead. Patients continued to come from all directions, and since we were not far removed from the center of the explosion, those who came were in critical condition. Their behavior was remarkable. Even though the ones in the hospital fared little better than those on the outside, they were grateful for a pallet in the most crowded ward. It seemed to satisfy them if they could get so much as a glimpse of a white-robed doctor or nurse. A kind word was enough to set them crying. For the most trivial service, they would clasp their hands and pray for you. All were sufferers together and were confident that the doctors and nurses would do best for them. Later, word came that this hospital was considered a good place to be in. The remark pleased us, but we were never able to feel that we had done as much as we should. Earlier in the day, Mr. Imachi and those who worked with him in the kitchen managed to prepare some rice gruel, which they brought in by the bucketful and dished out with big wooden spoons. For me, this simple gruel made the one bright spot in the day. It was served again that afternoon, and the mouthful I had and the grain of rice that remained on my tongue made me feel that I was going to get well. But there were many who were too weak or too sick to eat. In time, the weakness of hunger added to their misery. Night approached, and still the only beds were straw mats laid over the concrete floor. Wounds were becoming more painful, and there were not enough drugs to make them easy. Fevers rose, and the patients became thirsty, but there was no one to bring cool water to quench the thirst. Dr. Harada, one of our pharmacists, was brought into the hospital severely burned and right after him, old Mrs. Seiki's son in the same condition. Miss Hinata, one of our nurses, had to be confined because of a severe diarrhea that had begun earlier in the day. Since there was no one to nurse her, her mother, despite being seriously burned, was trying to do the job. Mr. Mizoguchi came in. Dr. Hachiya, I must tell you that Miss Hinata and her mother have become worse. It doesn't look like either of them will live through the night, and old Mrs. Seiki's son is losing consciousness. All day I had listened to visitors telling me about the destruction of Hiroshima and the scenes of horror they had witnessed. I had seen my friends and wounded, their families separated, their homes destroyed. I was aware of the problems our staff had to face, and I knew how bravely they struggled against superhuman odds. I knew what the patients had to endure and the trust they put in the doctors and nurses who, could they know the truth, were as helpless as themselves. By degrees, my capacity to comprehend the magnitude of their sorrow, to share with them the pain, frustration, and horror, became so dulled that I found myself accepting whatever was told me with equanimity and a detachment I would have never believed possible. In 2 days, I had become at home in this environment of chaos and despair. I felt lonely, but it was an animal loneliness. I became part of the darkness of the night. There were no radios, no electric lights, not even a candle. The only light that came to me was reflected in flickering shadows made by the burning city. The only sounds were the groans and sobs of the patients. Now and then a patient in delirium would call for his mother, or the voice of one in pain would breathe out the word, "Irayo, the pain is unbearable, I cannot endure it." What kind of bomb was it that had destroyed Hiroshima? What had my visitors told me earlier? Whatever it was, it did not make sense. There could not have been more than a few planes. Even my memory would agree to that. Before the air raid alarm, there was the metallic sound of one plane and no more. Otherwise, why did the alarm stop? Why was there no further alarm during the 5 or 6 minutes before the explosion occurred? Reason as I would, I could not make the ends meet when I considered the destruction that followed. Perhaps it was a new weapon. More than one of my visitors spoke vaguely of a new bomb, a secret weapon, a special bomb. And someone even said that the bomb was suspended from 2 parachutes when it burst. Whatever it was beyond my comprehension. Damage of this order could have no explanation. All we had were stories, no more substantial than the clouds from which we had reached to snatch them. One thing was certain. Hiroshima was destroyed, and with it the army that had been quartered in Hiroshima. Gone were headquarters, gone the command post of the 2nd General Army, and the military school for young people, the general headquarters for the Western Command, the Corps of Engineers, and the Army Hospital. Gone was the hope of Japan. The war was lost. No more help would come from the gods. American forces would soon be landing, and when they landed, there would be street fighting, and our hospital would become a place of attack and defense. Had I not heard earlier that soldiers were coming to set up headquarters in the Communications Bureau, would we be turned out? There were no answers. Dr. Sasada, Miss Kato, and my wife were asleep. That was good, but there was no sleep for me. I heard footsteps, and a man appeared at the door, outlined in the flickering darkness. His elbows were out and his hands down, like the burned people I had seen on my way to the hospital. As he came nearer, I could see his face, or what had been his face, because this face had been melted away by the fire. The man was blind and had lost his way. You were in the wrong room, I shouted, suddenly stricken with terror. The poor fellow turned and shuffled back into the night. I was ashamed for having behaved as I did, but I was frightened. Now more awake than ever, every nerve taut, I could find no sleep. To the east, there was a perceptible lightening of the sky. My shouting must have awakened my wife, because she got up and left the room, I suppose to find the toilet. Before long, she was back. "What is the matter, Yeko-san?" I asked, sensing she was upset. "Oh, Tot-san," the hall was so full of patients that I could find nowhere to walk without disturbing someone, she answered, trying to suppress her agitation. I had to excuse myself every step I took. Oh, it was terrible. Finally, I stepped on somebody's foot, and when I asked to be excused, there was no answer. I looked down, and do you know what I had done? "What?" I asked. "I had stepped on a dead man's foot," she said, and with a shudder, moved nearer. Right now, we'll go to August 8th, 1945. The day began hot and clear. The sun was hardly up before my body was moist with oily sweat that dripped from my armpits and the inner sides of my thighs. Smoke no longer rose from the second floor. Dr. Sasada's face was more swollen this morning than yesterday, and blood-stained pus oozed from his bandaged arms and hands. I felt a wave of pity when I thought how he had used those hands to help me 2 days ago. A noise outside the window caused me to recall a patient I neglected to mention yesterday. From time to time during the night, I had heard him walking about, and this morning he was walking again. You could hear him especially well when he stumbled into the fence or against the building. "Has he been fed?" I asked Miss Kato. "Don't worry, doctor," replied Miss Kato. "There are plenty of potato leaves in the garden, so I don't think he'll be hungry." The patient we were talking about was a horse who had been burned and blinded by the fire. Whoever saw him first did not have the heart to turn him away, so he was put in the garden under our window. This garden had been a tennis court, but some time ago I had thought it could be better used as a garden, and I planted it in potatoes. My try at gardening caused no little amusement, and my potatoes came to be a joke. "Miss Kato," I asked, "don't you think we had better dig up the potatoes? They must be quite big by now." My companions laughed, and for a moment misery was forgotten. My left ankle began to hurt. Looking down, I discovered that it had become wet and sticky through the bandage. Miss Kato saw my concern and offered to change the dressing, and when she finished, the ankle felt better. While she was changing the dressing, though, I noticed a big blister on my left knee. This was a surprise because I could not recollect having received any burns. Later, I remembered the hot ember that struck my leg while I was lying in the garden behind the communications bureau. My appetite was better this morning, and I seemed to be stronger. Even my spirits were improved, and the dark thoughts that beset me during the night were less oppressive. Dr. Katsubi came in early. Instead of greeting him with a good morning, I asked him point blank when I could get up. He told me again that it would be at least a week before he could remove the stitches, and that I was to say no more about getting up until then. "You are too impatient," he said. "You should be thankful that you are going to live." That I might die had never crossed my mind, but now that Dr. Katsubi had spoken so bluntly, I realized that I must have been hurt worse than I thought. "Was I that bad off?" I asked, trying to appear nonchalant. "We were all worried about you," Dr. Katsubi started. "Perhaps you don't realize how much blood you lost. Why, you remained comatose for the better part of the night. Your wife, Miss Kato, and Dr. Sasada, as well as Dr. Koyama and I, one or the other of us, were at your side all night." "No wonder I remember so little of what happened that night," I replied, trying to pass off his comments lightly. "I should have been content to rest. Dr. Koyama was certainly doing a good job of running the hospital, and I was in touch with things. Not only did he keep me informed, but he referred matters to me for opinion where he might have acted without doing me that courtesy. A note, for example, came from Dr. Chodo, one of our dentists, which stated that he and his family were hiding in the hills behind Yoshida. His family was unhurt, but he had been badly burned and asked if someone could bring him to the hospital. I sent for him in spite of our critical shortage at the hospital. Another report informed us that the welfare department of the Communications Bureau had between 200 and 300 sleeping mats, or tatami, which could be procured for use in the hospital. Since these mats were roughly 3 by 6 feet in dimensions, the question arose, since we were so crowded, how we could get them under the patients. Mr. Serra and I felt that, crowded or not, sleeping mats must be used, even if it meant clearing all the corridors. A rumor that Mr. Yoshida, chief of the Communications Bureau, had been killed proved to be true. His charred body, identified by a belt buckle, was found near the hospital, and his remains were cremated in front of the Communications Bureau. In his death, we lost a kind and loyal friend. Another prominent person to be killed was Mayor Otsuka. I was startled to learn that I had been reported killed. The news was brought by two old friends, Mr. and Mrs. Nagayo of Nishihara, who came looking for Yako-san and me this morning. We were happy to disprove the report of my death. During the day, an effort was made to sort and rearrange the patients according to the nature and severity of their injuries, and not a few dead were found among the living, although fewer than yesterday. It irritated me when I heard the report, for I felt that the dead should be moved with greater dispatch in order to make room for the living. This is another example of my changed outlook. People were dying so fast that I'd begun to accept death as a matter of course and ceased to respect its awfulness. I considered a family lucky if it had not lost more than two of its members. How could I hold my head up among the citizens of Hiroshima with thoughts like that in my mind? Soldiers began to work again in the Communications Bureau. Dr. Koyama and I discussed the feasibility of getting them to help clear one of the floors for the patients quartered in the toilets and corridors. While we were talking, Dr. Hanaoka informed us that bloody diarrhea was increasing and that some had had as many as 60 stools before daybreak. For the next moment, a hospital annex in the Communications Bureau seemed less urgently needed than an enlarged isolation ward. So the soldiers were asked to help with the latter. The problem of how to reutilize the hospital came up for discussion because the fire-damaged second story had cooled down enough to be used. Before the fire, there had been 14 rooms above us, but since all the partitions were now destroyed, nothing remained but one single large room. The question as to who among the patients should be moved upstairs provoked lively debate, since it seemed at the time that the burnt-out second floor was far less desirable than the first, despite the crowding. It was finally decided that we, as staff members, should be the first to go up and leave the more desirable ground floor for patients from the outside. I was moved first, and when my stretcher cleared the landing, my inquiring eyes fixed on the stark and twisted remains of 30-odd iron bed frames, under each of which lay a white ash residue of the straw mattresses that had once covered them. There was not a sound bed frame on the floor, but after the 2 days spent lying on the concrete floor, the very sight of these beds was magnificent. Yako-san and I found beds near each other that were not too badly bent. Our sleeping mats were placed over the frames, and without further ado, we were ready to resume life in our new quarters. Dr. Sasada, Miss Susukita, and Miss Omoto joined us, and one by one other members of the staff were brought up until the big room became alive with people. One might have complained about the soot and ashes or about the pipes and curtain rods that hung crazily from the ceiling, but patients never lived in a hospital ward so nearly free of bacteria as this one that was sterilized by fire. In all four walls, were large casement windows which afforded a commanding view in every direction. There were no shutters, no curtains, nor even glass to impose the least obstruction to air or light. Looking east, south, and west was an unobstructed view of Hiroshima, and in Hiroshima Bay, we could see the island Ninoshima. Near the center of the city, some 1,500 meters distant, one could see the blackened ruins of the two largest buildings in Hiroshima, the Fukuoka Department Store and the Chogoku Press Building. Hijiyama, the sacred and beautiful little mountain to the eastern sector of the city, looked almost close enough to touch. To our north, no buildings remained. For the first time, I could understand what my friends had meant when they said Hiroshima was destroyed. Nothing remained except a few buildings of reinforced concrete, two of which I had just mentioned. For acres and acres, the city was like a desert, except for scattered piles of brick and roof tile. I had to revise my meaning of the word destruction or choose some other word to describe what I saw. Devastation may be a better word, but really, I know of no word or words to describe the view from my twisted iron bed in the fire-gutted ward of the communications hospital. I could see the soldiers working on our isolation ward. One took the lead in a work song, and the others answered in chorus, verse for verse. In no time, a 10-subo addition to the ward was completed. Behind this, they constructed an outdoor toilet with partitions of straw mats. From where I lay, the mats provided no concealment. A gentle breeze blew through the windows, bringing relief to our fevered bodies. Gone were the confusion and disorder we had known downstairs. The abundant light from wide-open windows and the distant vistas did something to our spirits. The very simplicity of our surroundings, contrasted with the chaos below, had a soothing effect. We thought we had left the better part of the hospital for the patients downstairs, but now that we had moved in, all agreed that ours were the better quarters. I resolved to have this room made available to the others as soon as possible. Towards evening, a light southerly wind blowing across the city wafted to us an odor suggestive of burning sardines. I wondered what could cause such a smell until somebody, noticing it too, informed me that sanitation teams were cremating the remains of people who had been killed. Looking out, I could discern numerous fires scattered about the city. Previously, I assumed the fires were caused by burning rubble. Towards Negutsu was an especially large fire where the dead were being burned by hundreds. To suddenly realize that these fires were funeral pyres made me shudder, and I became a little nauseated. Concrete buildings near the center of the city, still afire on the inside, made eerie silhouettes against the night sky. These glowing ruins and the blazing funeral pyres set me to wondering if Pompeii had not looked like this during its last days. But I think there were not so many dead in Pompeii as there were in Hiroshima. For nearly 3 days, the hospital staff had been laboring with scarcely a break. So tonight, in order to give them a little respite, a space was cleared in our upstairs ward and alternate shifts were ordered to rest. Dr. Koyama stopped to talk a few minutes before lying down and told me some of the things that had happened during the day. In the morning, a group of soldiers had come to the entrance, demanding bandages for the 2nd General Army. And despite the staff's assertion that our materials were low, made away with nearly all we had. These men behaved more like brigands than soldiers. Moreover, what they did was contrary to what we had been told to expect, because the Army had repeatedly promised to supply us with emergency goods in case of attack. These soldiers could not have come from the army that had been stationed in Hiroshima. There were not enough soldiers left in that group to help with the wounded soldiers brought to the hospital. The army was unable to provide for the wounded family of the local commandant, whom we had made room for in one of the toilets. When the commandant's adjutant found them, He could find no better place to take them and was grateful when we managed to squeeze them into the janitor's office. The soldiers who got our supplies must have come from somewhere else. We had further cause to worry. Dr. Koyama told me that soldiers from somewhere had been around all day cleaning out the communications bureau, and that rumors were current that an army headquarters was to be set up to direct a defense of Hiroshima in case of invasion. We both agreed that if an army should move in, our hospital would become a target for more bombing, and next time we would all be killed. After Dr. Koyama left, I continued to think along these lines, became upset, and could not sleep. I could hear every little sigh during the night, every plea for water, every groan. One of the dysentery patients who had been transferred to the isolation ward went to the back of the bureau to get a drink of water. I heard a rude man scold him and tell him to go away lest he passes dysentery on to him. One voice called repeatedly for water, and as the night wore on, the voice became weaker. I asked a nurse who the patient was, and she told me that he was a young officer who appeared to be from a decent family, because every time she gave him a drink of water, he thanked her politely. Mention of the young officer called to mind a visit Yako-san and I had had on the 2nd of August. A cousin, Captain Urabe, and his wife spent the day with us. Captain Urabe had been recruited as an army doctor shortly after he graduated from medical school. And when I saw him, he had been eating army food for 6 or 7 years in northern and central China. To me, he appeared well-disciplined and courageous. I was pessimistic about the outcome of the war and told him so. I confided that I thought we were going to lose because everything was becoming scarce and the soldiers were no longer disciplined. I said that I was afraid Hiroshima was going to be bombed and that if it were, the anti-aircraft guns would be useless. Our defenses had been prepared for incendiary bombing, and I considered it nonsensical to think the enemy would use incendiary bombs on a city with as many rivers and vacant lots as there were in Hiroshima. To this, my cousin listened calmly and then replied, "Nissan, don't you worry for a minute. The chief of staff has said that no matter how much the nation criticizes the army will reply with victory." As I lay there in the dark, I mumbled to myself, "Reply with victory." Where was my cousin now? If I could find him, he might be able to get us the medical supplies we needed. Captain Urabe must be busy, otherwise he would have come to see me before now. Next we'll go on to August 9th, 1945. The day began hot and clear, but upstairs the sun did not shine directly on us as it had downstairs. In addition, a cool breeze that blew right across the ward helped make our situation altogether more agreeable than it had been yesterday. My mouth was more comfortable this morning, so the healing of my lip and cheek must be progressing satisfactorily. Indeed, I felt so much better that I asked if I might have some rice to eat instead of rice gruel. Miss Kato, always thoughtful, dug some of the sweet potatoes I had planted and prepared them for me. I do not think sweet potatoes ever tasted so good. My wife, although still with her arm in a sling, was so much better this morning that she took care of me. I was amused to hear her ask for some white ointment, which she put over her brows to conceal the fact that her eyebrows had been singed. Her returning vanity was a good sign. Dr. Sasada was worse this morning. His temperature had increased, and he was weaker. The sun had not been up long before visitors again appeared. One of the most welcome was a sturdy soldier who staggered in under a load of bandages and drugs much too large for one person to carry. He had been sent by Lieutenant Tanaka of the Akatsuki Corps. Not only was I pleased to receive the badly needed medical supplies, but it was good to learn that Lieutenant Tanaka was alive. I had known this young officer through my cousin, Captain Urabe. His thoughtfulness was gratefully acknowledged by everyone. There was another surprise. His Excellency, Mr. Okamoto, head of the Western District of the Communications Ministry, came to see me. I had heard a good deal about him, naturally, but had not had an opportunity to meet him. He was a sociable, friendly man who immediately put me at ease. When he discovered, by coincidence, that I had followed him 6 years in the same high school in Okayama, all barriers of authority disappeared, and we fell to talking of old times. He was on the way to Hiroshima when the bombing occurred, and would have been here at the time had he not been stung by a bee near Kure, a city 25 miles south of Hiroshima, with the result that he stopped off for treatment. That bee saved his life. During conversation with Mr. Okamoto, I sat up without thinking, from deference to my distinguished visitor. After he left, I suddenly realized that it had not hurt to sit up. If I could sit without pain, could I not stand? I waited until no one was looking and tried. But the stitches in my hip began to pull, so somewhat crestfallen, I was obliged to lie down. Nevertheless, this experience inspired me with confidence. Once my stitches were out, I was convinced I could be active again. Today, Dr. Hanaoka's report on the patients was more detailed. One observation particularly impressed me. Regardless of the type of injury, nearly everybody had the same symptoms. All had a poor appetite, the majority had nausea and gaseous indigestion, and over half had vomiting. Not a few had shown improvement since yesterday. Diarrhea, though, continued to be a problem and actually appeared to be increasing. Distinctly alarming was the appearance of blood in the stools of patients who earlier had only diarrhea. The isolation of these people was becoming increasingly difficult. One seriously ill man complained of a sore mouth yesterday, and today numerous small hemorrhages began to appear in his mouth and under his skin. His case was the more puzzling because he came to the hospital complaining of weakness and nausea and did not appear to have been injured at all. This morning, other patients were beginning to show small subcutaneous hemorrhages, and not a few were coughing and vomiting blood in addition to passing it in their stools. One poor woman was bleeding from her privates. Among these patients, there was not one with symptoms typical of anything we knew, unless you could excuse those who developed signs of severe brain disease before they died. Dr. Hanaoka believed the patients could be divided into three groups. Those with nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea who were improving. Those with nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea who were remaining stationary. And those with nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea who were developing hemorrhage under the skin or elsewhere. Had these patients been burned or otherwise injured, we might have tried to stretch the logic of cause and effect and assume that their bizarre symptoms were related to injury, but so many patients appeared to have received no injury whatsoever that we were obliged to postulate an insult heretofore unknown. The only other possible cause for the weird symptoms observed was a sudden change in atmospheric pressure. I had read somewhere about bleeding that follows ascent to high altitudes and about bleeding in deep-sea divers who ascend too rapidly from the depths. Having never seen such injury, I could not give much credence to my thoughts. Still, it was impossible to dismiss the thought that atmospheric pressure had had something to do with the symptoms of our patients. During my student days at Okayama University, I had seen experiments conducted in a pressure chamber. Sudden temporary deafness was one symptom everyone complained of if pressure in the chamber was abruptly altered. Now I could state positively that I heard nothing like an explosion when we were bombed the other morning, nor did I remember any sound during my walk to the hospital as houses collapsed around me. It was as though I walked through a gloomy, silent motion picture. Others whom I questioned had had the same experience. Those who experienced the bombing from the outskirts of the city characterized it by the word pikadon. And just to insert here, pika, Japanese word for flash, don, the Japanese word for boom, put them together, flash, boom, or picadon. Back to the story. How then could one account for my failure and the failure of others to hear an explosion, except on the premise that a sudden change in atmospheric pressure had rendered those nearby temporarily deaf? Could the bleeding we were beginning to observe be explained on the same basis? Since all books and journals had been destroyed, there was no way to corroborate my theories except by further appeal to the patients. To that end, Dr. Katsube was asked to discover what else he could when he made ward rounds. It was pleasing to note my scientific curiosity was reviving, and I lost no opportunity to question everyone who visited me about the bombing of Hiroshima. Their answers were vague and ambiguous, and on one point only were they in agreement. A new weapon had been used. What the new weapon was became a burning question. Not only had our books been destroyed, but our newspapers, telephones, and radios as well. Dr. Choto, our dentist, whom I spoke of earlier as having fled with his family to the Yoshida Hills, was brought in and assigned with his family to the waiting room of the dental department. I asked the nurse who helped bring him in how he was. Dr. Choto is in serious condition, she told me. It is frightful to see all of him burned and glistening with oozing secretions. I don't believe he will live. How about his wife and daughter? I asked. They weren't hurt, answered the nurse. Poor Dr. Choto. He and his family only recently came up from Okinawa and had no relatives here and few friends. What would happen to his family if he died? While I lay there brooding over Dr. Choto, old Mrs. Saike came up quietly and stood by my bed. One look into her pale, careworn face, and I knew what she had come to say. Her son was dead, her eldest son, her only child left in the world. She had been so hopeful yesterday when he was brought in, and now he was gone. Her son's wife and her second son had been killed on the day of the picadon, and no one was left. She put her hands over her eyes and cried, but her sobs were scarcely audible. I could not speak for a while because there was something in my throat. Oba-san, I said when I could control my voice, don't worry, I will look after you hereafter. Old Mrs. Saike stood for a while, crying quietly. Then she said, please help me, doctor. And without saying anything more, turned and went downstairs. My thoughts returned to Dr. Harada. Except for the top of his head, every inch was burned, leaving his pus-glistening body red and raw. A circle of black hair covered the only surface that had not been cooked. From a distance, it looked like he was wearing a cooking pot. He and Dr. Choto were near the Asano Sente Park when the explosion occurred. Before the day was out, Dr. Harada had died, and his wife's family took his corpse to their home in Kabi. Dr. Okura, another of our dentists, went out this morning to look for his wife, missing since the day of the bombing. He returned later with some bones that he picked up where she had been last seen. Mr. Yamazaki, in the business office, was still trying to find his daughter, but without success. Dr. Fuji finally found his daughter, but she was beyond help. She died in a friend's house in Midori. There was no more good news today. Dr. Morisugi in our internal medical department was still missing, and since he had lived near the center of the explosion, we assumed that he and his entire family were killed. Three of our nurses had been killed, and Miss Hinata, who seemed to be all right before her diarrhea started, was dying. Towards evening, the young officer died, whom I heard begging for water last night. His mother, coming all the way from Yamaguchi Prefecture, found him a few minutes after he had drawn his last breath. A little girl was given the young officer's bed in the isolation ward. Her cries for her mother were heartbreaking. Darkness came, and still there were no lights except the lights from the fires where the dead were burned, and again the smell of burning flesh. The hospital was quieter, But in the isolation ward, the stillness of the night was broken again and again by the little girl. "Mother," she would cry, "it hurts. I can't stand it." Not until the eastern sky began to brighten did I fall into troubled sleep. Moving on now to August 10th, 1945. There was a cool breeze when I awakened this morning. After an exchange of good mornings, I asked my companions how they had fared through the night. Those who could raised their heads, the other their hands. Happily, no one had expired. Outside, people were combing the ruins in search of friends or relatives. To the south, along the streetcar line that had run between Hachobori and Hakushima, people walked in an unending stream on their way to and from the hills and neighboring villages in search of people or possessions they had lost. A message was brought me concerning Miss Yama, our head nurse in surgery. She was critically ill in a dugout near Yokogawa. I passed the news on to Dr. Katsubi and Miss Takao because they were particularly close friends. The moment they learned where Miss Yama was, they set out at once to find her. Miss Takao was in such haste that she followed Dr. Katsubi in some old sandals that would not have lasted 5 minutes. "Tomi-chan," I called out to Miss Takao, "you can't go out in those broken-down sandals. You'll never reach Yokogawa. Here, take my shoes." Discarding her broken-down sandals, Miss Takao put on my shoes and went clomping out after Dr. Katsubi. How she kept them on was a miracle, because she could have put both feet in one shoe. I could picture her toiling and panting to keep up with Dr. Katsubi, the perspiration dripping from her chubby face. Easygoing and good-natured, and fat and roly-poly as Ebisu-sama, the god of wealth, she made a good companion for Dr. Katsubi. This morning I had boiled rice instead of rice gruel. What a difference it made. With solid food in my stomach, I felt like doing something. Why should I not take advantage of Dr. Katsubi's absence and try to walk again? To my delight, I found I could walk, and even the stitches did not seem to pull too much. After a few steps, I was convinced that all I needed was practice. While trying my wings, so to speak, I heard footsteps and turned to find Mr. Mizoguchi approaching my bed. "Doctor, you had better be careful," he admonished, "or you will overdo it. May I have a few words with you?" "Certainly," I replied, a little sheepishly, since he found me out of bed. "It concerns our medical supplies," stated Mr. Mizoguchi, politely ignoring my embarrassment. "They are almost exhausted. What few there are, we tried to distribute equitably between the inpatients and the outpatients, but the outpatients have increased so that soon there will be nothing to give anybody. The bundle given you yesterday is the only addition to our stock since the bombing, and what emergency stores there are in Jigo-zen and Yaguchi can't be reached." "Ask Dr. Koyama if he is busy," I replied. "Perhaps he could suggest some way out of this dilemma." Dr. Koyama came up, and I repeated what Mr. Mizoguchi had said and asked for his suggestions. "No," answered Dr. Koyama after a thoughtful pause. "I see no solution unless we can get someone to help us from the outside. The prefectural office promised help, you know." "Then let's close the outpatient department," I replied. "At least what little we have left can be saved for the inpatients." "That would never do," replied Dr. Koyama. "Those who come as outpatients need help as badly as those inside, and if we refuse them, where can they go?" At this point, I lost my temper. 4 days have passed," I shouted, "and still we have received no supplies. Even if the prefectural office keeps its promise and sends supplies, there still won't be enough. You have enough to do worrying about problems in the hospital without trying to care for every transient who comes to the door. You must close the outpatient department, I tell you. You must close it today." Dr. Koyama seemed to realize that my injuries, my insomnia, my brooding over hospital problems had made me unreasonable, for he tried to soothe me. I responded by showing contrition one moment and anger the next. In the end, perhaps for fear I would become completely unreasonable, he bowed to my insistent requests and promised to post a notice that the outpatient department would be closed. The notice was hardly up before police and officials from the prefectural office appeared to ask why we had made such a rule. The effect was sensational. They begged us to continue the outpatient department for the sake of the Hiroshima citizens. We would be glad to, we told them, but for the fact that our supplies were exhausted and no one had made any effort to replace them. In answer, they promised to find us supplies if only we would reopen the clinic. Perhaps my insistence that the notice be posted was not so unreasonable after all. Before they could change their minds, Dr. Hinoi was dispatched to the sanitary department of the prefectural office for the promised supplies. But what they gave him was scarcely worth mentioning. The bundle he returned with was no bigger than the tears of a sparrow. This concludes our reading of Hiroshima Diary by Michihiko Achiya. For Free Radio, this is Captain Fred.